This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I have a very special guest, Noelle Obiora. It's a debut novel, crime fiction, and it's a really exciting book, and I'm looking forward to talking to him now. But now I get to talk, talking about crime, evil, the subject of evil. And I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Serena Valentino. Hi, Serena.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Oh, great. Well, the new book is called Cold Hearted, and it's going to be another big New York Times best-selling book, part of this entire series that you are doing. Quite amazing. Just the cover alone is so, so good.
Did you look under the cover?
Oh, yes. I always look. I am a book person, and so the first thing I did, of course, was to take off the cover, because I'm very careful with covers, and I saw what they did. It is so lovely, and I'm holding it up. We're also on YouTube here, so I can show people. What a cover. They did such a terrific job, didn't they? Disney Hyperion is just wonderful.
Yes, I love the job that they do on the covers. They're amazing, and they're all like that. If you take the cover off, there's another image on the inside, and that's something that the readers really enjoy. They're always looking forward to seeing, what iteration of the villain is going to be on the inside.
Exactly, and also the high-quality paper they use. I just love their production values.
Me too. I'm very lucky.
You're very lucky, and, of course, you're also very talented, and you've deserved all this. My goodness, you are... Whew, This has been exciting for you to be involved in all of these books.
It is. It has been very exciting, yes, especially with the last book coming out, hitting the New York Times bestsellers list. I was blown away.
Wow.
It's overwhelming, but in a good way.
It's absolutely fantastic. And this one, as I said, is called Cold Hearted. Woo! Where do we start with this? Because, I should have introduced you. I should have said, that you are like the mistress of all evil. Ooh, that's one of the titles. But I like to think of you as the fairest of them all, because you're so cute. And it's, let's talk about this book. For people who don't know about this series, you're taking subjects and looking sort of deeper into them and changing some things around, and this particular one is, tell us about it.
Well, this particular story is the story of Lady Tremaine from Cinderella's story, the stepmother from Cinderella. And this story takes place, it starts off many years after Cinderella has already gone to the castle with her prince, and she's now the queen. And she hears that her old chateau is being haunted by the ghost of Lady Tremaine and her evil stepsisters, Drusilla and Anastasia. But she comes to find out that they're not ghosts at all, that they're there and they're trapped in her old chateau. And they're living in deplorable, horrible conditions. And Anastasia and Drusilla are desperately sad and, want to leave. So she appeals to the fairy godmother to help them the way that fairy godmother helped her originally. But the fairy godmother refuses to help Anastasia and Drusilla because, they're the wicked stepsisters. So the fairies all get together and have a council, and they read from the Book of Fairy Tales, which is an ongoing book like in the series, to read Lady Tremaine's story and to see, how her story came about, what her life was like before she came to the Many Kingdoms to live with Cinderella's father. and to decide if Anastasia and Dozoa are worthy of being helped. That's an ongoing theme, like in the series. There are some fairies who want to help everybody, and there's some fairies who only want to help the princesses.
Well, that's life. There's a it wouldn't be interesting if we didn't have people who disagreed on what they were going to do.
Right, right. I mean, some of the fairies feel that if, say, you know, the evil stepmother, you know, the wicked queen from Snow White, for example, had a fairy godmother, then she wouldn't have gone down the path that she had gone down. If Maleficent had somebody who was looking after her, she wouldn't have taken the path that she took. But some fairies believe there's some people who are born to be evil, and there's some people who are born to be princesses. And there's a group of fairies who are trying to say, no, everybody deserves help. So this story really, really tackles that.
So when you got to this story, of course, you've done your historical research into the background of Cinderella, which is quite fascinating in and of itself. Luckily, the Disney is not based on the Grimm fairy tale, which is rather dark.
It is very dark. Before I started writing books for Disney, I was a comic book writer, and I used to do fairy tale adaptations that were closer to the Grimm's fairy tales, and so they were pretty graphic, as you would imagine. Being based on the original tales. So you have to, you know, think. I was really surprised when Disney approached me and asked if I wanted to do work with them. I was like, well, have you seen my other work? It's pretty graphic. But it's nice. Disney gives me a lot of freedom, and the stories that I do for them are a lot darker than you would expect. I tackle a lot of different things, like you know child abuse growing up and abuse in relationships and, you know, in things like that, things that you might not expect to see in a Disney novel.
But they're not as bloody as if they were based on Grimm, because Grimm was a perfect name for those brothers, because when you look back on it, some of those stories are pretty awful.
Right. Well, I mean, I think in Cinderella, the stepsisters, you know, chopped their feet off.
Oh, yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, it is. It's not quite as bloody as that, but yeah. There are novels in which we do get a little bloody, yeah. Surprisingly so for a Disney novel.
Well, of course, this one is based more on the French version by Charles Perrault, which is much nicer, and includes all the so many of the things that we associate now with Cinderella. But you took liberties. you took some liberties there, girl.
Well, when I do these books for Disney, I pretty much have free rein to do what I like with anything outside of the events from the film. So, you know, anything that happens before the film, anything happens after the film, I can you know, decide what's going on, you know, in the story. And then if I include events from the film, then I have to follow the film events. But I do get to take liberties because it's from the villain's point of view. So
you're having fun, you're saying, and getting paid for it.
Yes. It's the best job, you know, one could ask for, having fun, playing with these amazing characters and getting paid. It's fantastic.
What more can you ask for? It's fantastic. It is fantastic. That's the word for it. And of course, you know, for people who are fans of the Cinderella story itself, this is a different look at things. I sort of skipped that stage because I was reading at such a young age. I went from really comic books to suddenly, you know, I'm reading. My first book that I read before I was 5 years old, the first real book I read, a Perry Mason, paperback my mother had, and I read the entire book, and I wasn't even, you know, I was before kindergarten. So I sort of skipped that, you know, fairy tale period. I never got into that when I was young. So other than later on seeing the Disney movies, which I loved, I never actually read those books.
Right. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by fairy tales. I don't know that I got into them so much when I was younger either. But as I got older, I got really intrigued by them, and they've always been an ongoing theme in the various things that I've written. I find them very fascinating and inspiring.
Well, that certainly caught the attention of Disney when they were looking for somebody who had enough of a sort of dark background to make this whole series, you know, this evil series, interesting.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel very lucky that I got the attention of an editor that worked over at, you know, Disney back when I was doing my comic books. And, you know, I've been writing novels for them ever since. So it's been a dream come true, actually.
So, well, how did you get involved in writing comic books in the first place?
I had a story that I wanted to tell. I had a friend who's a comic book illustrator. I wrote a little story and I shared it with him, and he thought it would make a good comic. So he and I worked together figuring out what the illustrations would be. We photocopied it. We did like a self-publishing thing at, you know, the copy store. We took it to San Diego Comic-Con and passed it around, hoping to get the attention of a publisher. And lo and behold, that first San Diego Comic-Con, a publisher said that he was interested in having us submit for consideration. And I honestly hadn't thought about what would happen in the series beyond that one little story. So I brainstormed on the plane ride home, wrote up, a proposal when I got home. The illustrator, you know, did all the illustrations that he needed to do. We submitted, and we got published. It was kind of like a crazy whirlwind situation of, you know, the fact that, like, the very first thing I ever wrote got published still astounds me.
Well, it's a lovely story. It just shows what people can accomplish if they try. If you just sit at home and, you know, don't get out there and push yourself, nothing's going to happen. But simply by going to a convention, it's hard to believe that, you know, there you get this wonderful deal, and from there you land up on the New York Times best-selling list. I mean, that is fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think about, you know, so many talented people out there who are submitting, and they, you know, and they are working hard, and they're struggling. And so I hate saying, like, that was my, you know, what my experience was, because I hate for anybody to feel discouraged, you know, because rejection is a huge part of being, you know, being a writer. It's just, I so happened to be just the right timing, and I was really lucky, you know, to get published as quickly as I did.
Well, you are lucky and blessed, and now that you see what it's like, and I like that you think about other people, about their struggles, and acting as an inspiration, really, that people have to know, you know, you have these ideas in your head, and one of the things I've been doing during this pandemic year is telling people, well, go ahead and find the joy on paper that I'm talking about. Write your story, the book that's in your head, or in your case, the comics, the drawing. So did you start out to be a writer or an artist?
Writer. I work with various artists.
So you didn't do the drawings yourself?
No.
And so once you saw, but you had the words on paper, which isn't that a joy? It doesn't make you feel good when you see your words on paper?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what you're saying is something very similar to something that I would say to my old students. I used to teach a comic book writing class, and, you know, I would always tell them to write the story that they always wanted to read, write the story that they're going to love. Because, you know, they're not sure if it's ever going to get published. So they, at least at the end of the day, they'll have something that they love and something that they're happy that they wrote. And because that's really all, you know, that's really all you may get out of it. If you're blessed enough to be able to share it with the world, then fantastic. But at least, you know, create something from your heart, you know, something that you feel, that you're going to feel proud of.
Well, that's important, exactly. That get it out there, and there are so many possibilities today. It's not just that you might find a publisher, you might publish it yourself, but it's still there. It's there for you and forever, and for your family and your friends, and it really makes life, doesn't it make life interesting to be out there and meeting all the people that now you're meeting because of your writing?
It is very interesting. I feel really lucky to have such a wonderful readership. They're all very kind. It's like a really wonderful community. They're very supportive. They've been my champions, like, throughout the beginning of the series. And some of the people who read my books have been, you know, following me since I was doing comics. And since the beginning, they've always just, you know, championed me on, you know, because there's times when you want to give up, you know, you feel like you're struggling. I mean, I've been through periods where I was submitting and I wasn't getting any work, but because my readership was there and because they're always so supportive and telling me how much they, you know, love my work, I kept going. And I love it. It's a fantastic experience. I woke up this morning to tons of emails and Facebook messages and Twitter messages and Instagram messages from all my fans celebrating the fact that the book is, you know, coming out today. And I just, you know, it doesn't get old. This is the 8th book, and I'm just as excited. Every time a new book comes out, it's just as exciting as the first.
Well, I think it's just fantastic, and it's wonderful what you've accomplished. 8 books, and they are all so beautiful. I want to just, again, say to Disney Hyperion, they are so good, and this, I think it is great also for young people to have really nice books in their hand. I think it makes a difference to have this feeling of a really top quality book.
Yeah, they're beautifully put together. I can't even tell you how wonderful it is, you know, not only to have a book published, but to have it, like, you know, designed and package so well. It just makes it even better.
It does, and it makes it great for the reader. And are you doing, probably there aren't that many tours that you're doing right now. Are you doing Zoom tours, Zoom events?
I am, yeah. I've been doing, like, Zoom events, and I think it's called, like, StreamYard, you know, events with, like, bookstores. And then a couple days from now, I'll be doing like a full day, like, radio tour. So it's all been virtual. This evening, I'm doing an event with Creepy Kingdom, their Creepy Book Club. They've been following my book since the beginning, and they do a review every month. And I always watch them on YouTube, and I think they're delightful people. And I started watching and commenting live on YouTube, and they asked if I'd like to be on the show, so I'm very excited about doing that tonight.
So can people find that on your website? You have a website?
My website, unfortunately, is down, and I've been so busy trying to, like, you know, do all this other stuff, but they can find it on my Facebook. It's on Facebook, it's on Twitter, and it's on Instagram. I've been promoting it all day.
Okay, and it's a lovely name, so people can remember Serena Valentino. I love that name. Perfect.
Oh, thank you.
Easy to remember. It sounds like such a sweet name, and you sound so sweet, but you write so beautifully about evil.
I know. That's what people say.
Well, congratulations. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And the name of the book is Cold Hearted, and it is available. Cold Hearted Villains in parentheses. Oh, my goodness. Yes. And it is available online and hopefully in bookstores that are opening again. Yes. Thank you, Serena, so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. You have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Doesn't she sound sweet? And then she writes these horror. Well, I mean, they're not gross. They're just sort of devilishly evil. Now, we're going to have a little, what I am calling literary gems from somebody who's very close to me, Jim Lamb. He's been listening to the program since it started. He's so, so wonderful. And we decided that what we're going to do is just to spur all of you people on who are thinking of writing or just starting to write some literary gems. And this one is from Jim Lamb. And let's go ahead.
Here's the headline. Add some spice to your writing with metaphor magic. Here's the short version. A metaphor is a figure of speech that describes an object or action in a way that isn't literally true, yet helps reveal its true nature. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. Virginia Woolf once said, "Books are the mirrors of the soul." I've got a book here right in front of me. I'm looking at it. I can't see my soul. I can't even see my face. What did Virginia mean? That's something upon which we can reflect. Shakespeare, the bard, said, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances." Hey, wait a minute. I didn't get a script. Did you get a script? Where's my script? Mother Teresa put it this way. I'm a little pencil in the hand of a writing god who is sending a love letter to the world. Mother Teresa, a pencil? Books as mirrors? The world a stage? Welcome to the magical land of metaphors, where nothing is quite what it seems. Metaphors are everywhere. Even presidents use them. On November 21st, 1963, the day before he died, President John F. Kennedy dedicated the Aerospace Medical Health Center in San Antonio, Texas. Here's what he said. "America has tossed its cap over the wall of space." Now, you and I both know that space is not a wall. But Kennedy used that metaphor to illustrate America's commitment to landing a man on the moon, a promise he'd made just a year before. By the way, we did make it to the moon 50 years ago, on July 21st, 1969. Promise made, promise kept. Some metaphors are elegant, like when Pablo Picasso said, "Art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life." How about this beautiful remark from Cahill Gibran? "All our words are but crumbs that fall down from the feast of the mind." Here's one of the most famous metaphors of all time. "I am the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep." Jesus said that. On the other hand, some metaphors are less than elegant. Like when Bob Dylan said, "Chaos is a friend of mine." Would you like chaos as a friend? Not me. Not even for one day, that's for sure. Metaphors can be funny. Like when Groucho Marx said, "A hospital bed is a parked taxi with a meter running." That makes me laugh. Others can be warm and fuzzy. Metaphors can also be provocative. "Advertising is a rattling of a stick inside a swill bucket." Yuck. George Orwell, author of the infamous 1984, wrote that disgusting little gem. He also wrote a little book called Animal Farm that's chock full of metaphors and symbolism, far too many to mention here. But metaphors are not just for the intelligentsia. Everyday guys and gals, ditch diggers, waitresses, and even tech service personnel use them. For example, have you ever been in an uncomfortable conversation where everybody's ignoring the elephant in the room? Or having to delay going outside because it's raining cats and dogs? Or after losing an argument, you continue to beat a dead horse. What did that feel like? Didn't you know the horse was dead? Couldn't you see it was deceased, departed, passed on, gave up the ghost, kicked a bucket, met its maker? Just let it rest in peace, okay? Remember, if you didn't like my metaphoric shtick, don't shoot the messenger. Then you'd be going down a slippery slope, and that would be a dead end, for sure. Let me leave you with this thought from Yogi Berra. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about metaphors.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Noel A. Obiora. And he has written, this is his debut novel, and it is called A Past That Breathes. Hi, Noel.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, good morning. Well, it is so nice to be able to talk to you for many reasons, because I found your background so interesting. And, of course, the book is so very, very good. And this is...
Thank you.
It's a crime book. It's a book about a trial. And it has... There are just many reasons that I really enjoy this book. But I also was intrigued by your background, and later on we'll talk about why you mentioned that one of your favorite books is Bleak House, because it's not normally the book that people think about for Dickens. But first let's talk about this book. You know, A Past That Breathes, I was really intrigued with the... I love books about trials, and I love I like books about lawyers, and of course written by a lawyer. So so you sort of hit everything out here in the ballpark. Tell us about this book, because what it does is it covers a very important subject at this time, but you also do it so... I just love your characters. I found myself really caring about Amy and Kenneth, and you can explain who they are, which is so important in a novel, that we really are interested and care about the characters.
Thank you so much. Yes, the book came out of my practice in Los Angeles. When I finished, I went to law school in Texas at the University of Austin, School of Law at Austin, you know, the University of Texas School of Law at Austin. And then I moved out to California because I really wanted to write and also practice law at the same time. And while I was practicing, you know, starting my practice, I just found that the ideals and the ideas that we come out of law school, you know, trying to fight the power and do all that, just wasn't, you know, what... It just wasn't what you see in films. It wasn't what you were reading in books. It, you know, the books that, you know, motivated you. And I really wanted to write from my own perspective of that practice. I wanted to just show that my experience and then what I believed and what I wanted to fight for and how they just weren't coming together in the realities of my own practice. I mean, there was only so much you could control, especially if you're a young sole practitioner trying to represent people who really didn't have the resources to retain an attorney. And so that's really where it came from, those frustrations, but also trying to be positive, because you really believe in the system. And once in a while you get a case that says, once in a while you get a case that says the little man can really win, you know, the person who doesn't have the resources. Is there anywhere in the world that they can make their case? This is the country to do it, and this is the system to do it. And that really motivates and keeps hope alive, you know.
Well, I found the story intriguing. Lay the background for us, because here we start off with a murder, and the man who is accused of the murder.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, tell us about these two characters.
Sure. So a young woman is a very brilliant musician who's just about to, you know, break out of break into stardom. Has just been found dead in her bathroom in West Los Angeles. We're very close to Beverly Hills and, you know, the very wealthy areas of West Los Angeles. And her doors were locked, so it looked like, you know, initially, if there weren't anything, any intruder or any criminal issues, it would be like an allergy or something in the house caused her or heart attack or anything. But the police rightly found that she was murdered. But her doors were locked. There was no break-in. And the investigators now found out that the day before she was arguing with this man who was her ex. And so they pretty much zeroed in on the man. Of course, using data on crime, you know, they say domestic crimes are likely to be someone you know or someone you're related to. And they just zeroed in on the man, but they didn't have a lot of the evidence to support it. They just had the fact that there was no witness and the dogs were locked, and this guy was very close to her. And they went with that. There was some evidence in the room that wasn't connected to this particular man they were zeroing in, but they didn't look like it was also connected to the crime. So they just didn't want to make that evidence muddy their investigation. And then the case, to make matters worse, the man who was accused of this crime really couldn't afford the big, expensive lawyers who usually do murder trials in Los Angeles. And so they had to really rely on a family friend who just started his practice, and the young man has never had a murder trial before. And so that's how the case starts. And when the DA gets it and finds the DA was struggling with a lot of cases that came out of the Los Angeles riot and was just overwhelmed with, you know, cases that were still going on 18 months after the riot and appeals that were still going on. And so they were also hired a young woman who was brilliant. I've been in the DA's office doing lesser cases for 3 years. And the two largely inexperienced lawyers were now handed this murder trial to take care of. And that's how the case developed.
What I liked about it, so we have these two young lawyers on opposite sides. The accused is... So that we have the racial part of the story, because he's a black man accused of killing a white woman, and all the dynamics that go that surround that, and the what you really take us into this world of the lawyers and sort of laying it out and getting us to care about both of the characters, about Amy and about Kenneth. I like Kenneth's mother. Kenneth is, you know, is a young lawyer. He's just struggling, you know, to have his own office and to keep going. And he's moved in with his mother, who I like very much. And all of these little nuances that you have in this story, I think, make for a very rich book. It carry through. You've just carried through the characters, and there's a rich writing pattern in all of this. I really was impressed with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. That was the other thing I really wanted to point out in how the lawyer's, a lawyer's life affects his own cases. You know, we bring our own. Everyone has their own baggage, and, you know, you wake up in the morning and you find that someone else's life is depending on you to solve it, you know, in a criminal case. But oftentimes you have your issues that may affect how you're feeling that morning. You may take that morning, but the system has to go on. The case has to go on. And so you're forced to bring who you are and what you're dealing with into this other life that really needs a very good and stellar representation. and you just have to fight and struggle through it. I really wanted to bring out that aspect of it, because sometimes what makes or breaks the case is not really in the fact of the case itself. It's in the preparation and the work that should have been done by someone who was probably dealing with something, you know, much more difficult or much more horrendous. And I wanted to bring those lives into the forefront of this novel, so that people will try to understand, you know, or at least, like you said, care about the characters as much as they care about the case as it develops.
Yes, I think that's very, very important. And the way you write it, it's very clever. You have twists and turns in there. We have, and this is the thing about law. You never know what's going to happen. Evidence appears suddenly. Witnesses, you have witnesses. You have changing stories. You have all these complications. And right from the beginning, even with the policeman, Alvarez, everyone that you write about, I felt that you really knew these people, that you understood these people and brought them to life. I was, as I said, I'm very impressed with your writing.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I tried very much to just try to put myself in the shoes of a lot of the people. Of course, a lot of it grew out of the realities of my practice, the people I met, and just trying to be objective about what their goals and their approach to solving the case were. A lot of Kenneth, of course, was drawn really from everything I was going through when I was a young man. I was about his age when I had my own practice in Los Angeles and doing that.
So you drew upon your experience and did it beautifully. And Amy is also very well written. And the dialogue is excellent. And I was going to mention that because I love when dialogue just flows very nicely. And I think that comes from some of your studies in drama and in the work that you did in England.
Yes. I came to writing primarily from drama. When we were in high school, in boarding school in Nigeria, we were part of what we called the dramatic club, because there was no, it wasn't really taught there. But those of us who wanted to put up plays and really were into it were part of the dramatic club. And oftentimes the library wouldn't have the books that we could take with our resources. So I took the initiative to write some of the plays, or write something that we could work with, or rewrite something that was written and make it possible for us to work on. So I really came to it from that. And after practicing law in L.A. for about 10 years, I decided I really wanted to go back to writing more as my primary self, and then making law like something to support myself. So I applied to the King's College London and the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts for a master's program. And then I went there, and my emphasis was also in playwriting. For my master's thesis, I had to write a play. So I did come from that part of writing dialogue and really enjoying my dialogue and trying to make them come to life.
And you do. You achieve that. And, of course, one of the things that I know I read a little bit that some of the influences in your writing, you mentioned Bleak House. And I was so happy that you did, because not many people read Bleak House, but it is really the best Charles Dickens novel. And I was pleased that you had read that.
It's an amazing novel. I remember reading that, and I remember reading that and just thinking to myself, how could something written so long ago just still become so relevant to understanding the legal system as it affected those who don't have the resources, or how the attitudes of lawyers can sometimes, is so well reflected in their attitudes today towards their clients, depending on the success or failure, depending on the expectations of recovery and all that. I just thought enjoying the characters. It was something that I thought was really relevant to what understanding the system going forward and where I was at the time. That influenced how I wanted to write. I wanted to write something that would continue to inform, would continue to provoke dialogue and discussion about these issues in our legal system and in our relationships going forward.
Well, you learn from the best, because that is a wonderful book for a legal writing. Par excellence. It's just so good, and most people don't realize it's a very long book, but it's so much fun to read. And of course, it actually had an enormous impact on the legal system in England, because he did write about injustice. He did write about all these problems, and the legal system was reformed in the 1870s because of this book.
Right. And he was writing from, again, a place of experience, you know, from when he was working in the court. He was seeing these characters, he knew these characters. It's almost the type of thing that he thought he needed to bring out, to let go of what you were trying, of what you saw that was just difficult to handle in terms of how the system addressed different classes of people.
Exactly, because, and it's always been that way, and it is one of the reasons that we have to always have these legal reforms, because sometimes the biases of the people involved in investigations can affect the outcome of a trial, because they already have their own predetermined ideas, and I think you address that very nicely in your book, The Past That Breeds, because it really does.
Yes, thank you. When a heinous crime happens, there's so much focus on, you know, getting whoever did it, or in just solving the crime, and sometimes we forget that process matters. You know, the processes, the due processes that the Constitution made part of the system is really important, even if we have to deal with a situation that we can't imagine actually took place. And I think in process, actually, is one of the few places, it's one of the few elements of law where you can treat people equally. I can, you know, in substance, if I say I'm going to treat these two people the same amount of money, as soon as it gets into their hands, the equality dissipates, because, you know, their expectations, their worries, their burdens will be different, and how much that money addresses it will be different. So, yeah, the distribution is equal, but the impact may not necessarily be. But in process, the impact continues to be equal once you, you know, decimate it appropriately and fairly, the impact would be equally fair and in that respect. And I think that that's sort of something people have to understand, especially lay people have to understand, that it is not just about doing things quickly or getting to the right answer, but it's more about, if I protect this process with respect to this individual, then I'm certain that if it ever becomes my case, if it ever becomes about me, that process will be equally and fairly applied to me. And that's part of, you know, what I was also trying to get across.
Well, I think you do a beautiful job, and I just want to, again, compliment you. It's always wonderful when you get your first book out. I'm sure that now that you got the first book, the other books will follow, right?
Thank you. I hope so. It took a while. And I learned a lot from it. I really learned a lot from it. Thank you so much.
Well, I think anyone who can make a reader really care about the characters, and I really did. Amy and Kenneth are two characters that I will remember for a long time, and that you were able to make them come alive, I think is fantastic, and I just want to compliment you again, and thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Do you have a website, or do you do Facebook? How can people find out more about you?
Yes, there is a website, thepatsatbreeds.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, and we're trying to, you know, get out a lot about the book that way.
And your last name?
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you pronounce your last name?
You got it right the second time. Obiora.
Obiora. Okay, and it's Noel. Obiora. It's a beautiful name. I love that name, Obiora.
Thank you.
And people, this is, you know, if you like legal books and courtroom books, and you're interested in sort of what's going on in the world of justice, this is just a great book to read. Actually, I'll tell you, I enjoyed this. Well, I won't mention an author who writes legal books, but I tell you, I enjoyed your book more than a very famous author's legal book. So, again, thank you so much for being on the program today, Noel. It was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks so much for how you presented with you. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. We're going to play a quick book buzz, because then I'm going to come back and talk about this author. This is for her latest release, and then I'm going to talk about the book, her new release. So let's...
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz. See Something, a Witch City Mystery Book 11 by fabulous Kensington author Carol J. Perry. Here's the buzz. Salem's WICH-TV program director Lee Barrett is about to discover no good deed goes unpunished. Lee has been promoted from field reporter to program director. Keeping track of all the shows and managing the local TV personalities, including a cowboy, a clown, and a performing dog, has her head spinning. Perhaps that's what makes her take pity on the distraught woman she finds sitting alone on a bench on the Salem Common. When she realizes that the poor woman doesn't even know her own name, Lee takes her into the warmth of her home she shares with her Aunt Ibby and their clairvoyant gentleman cat, Orion. Maybe Lee can use her own psychic gifts to divine the woman's identity. Lee's detective beau, Pete Mondello, wants to talk to the Jane Doe. But before he can investigate, he's called to a crime scene. A body has been found washed up in a narrow harbor cove. As harmless as her new house guest seems, Lee can't help but wonder if she may be harboring a killer. An entertaining story that keeps readers guessing until the very twisted and eerie end. Carol J. Perry was born in Salem, Massachusetts on Halloween Eve, and that magical city serves as the backdrop for her Witch City Mysteries. See Something, a Witch City Mystery Book 11 by fabulous Kensington author Carol J. Perry. For more of my suggestions on the mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
Okay, well, I wanted to play that because that is the most recent book that came out for Carol J. Perry. Her new series is coming out, and it is called A Haunted Haven Mystery Series. And it has been voted and selected for so many, many lists as the best, one of the best books, cozy mysteries for the summer. And I am so thrilled that, you know, Carol J. Perry was my first in-studio guest, and I am just in awe of what she has accomplished in these 6 years since I've known her. Her new book that's coming out is called Be My Ghost. It's going to come out in August. You can pre-order it, and one of the nicest things that you can do for an author is to pre-order their books. Amazon just loves pre-orders because if you pre-order, they just put you up there in the ranking, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing you can do. So anybody who, if you like cozy mysteries, you have to read this new series of Carol's. It has already... Publishers Weekly, every place is writing about this new series. She has accomplished an amazing, amazing feat here in 6 years. 11 of her Witch City mysteries, and now Be My Ghost, the first in the Haunted Haven mystery series. And she's working right now, I think busily right now at this very moment, probably typing away on book two because she has a deadline. So you can pre-order that, and it's just a wonderful thing that you can do for an author. Wow, this is what I'm talking about, this joy on paper. As I talked to Serena Valentino, look at what she did. She wrote a simple comic book, and I've looked back, and I've looked at her first comic books. Wow, it's... yeah, wow, it caught somebody's attention, and look where she is today. She's on the New York Times bestselling list at this very moment. And again, the book is released today, and she's hitting the... And this is what can happen to you. You never know. It's just so exciting. The book world can be so exciting. But it's not always just your sales. It's also that you've accomplished something and that you've done something that will go on and that your family can be proud of. Not everyone's going to have a bestseller, but you've accomplished something, and you've put those words on paper, and they'll live there forever. That's why you better write something nice. And please don't write... When I say words will live forever, I want to remind you people about the dangers of writing things on Facebook and other social media that you don't want to live forever. So never write anything on those places. And Bill Larson of Larson & Larson will be here again at the end of the month, and we'll talk about what you should not write. People don't write rude things. Really, they come back to haunt you. Oh, and also, I'm telling you, people really watch your language. There's a limit, and I've been just about hit with the limit recently. I'm not reviewing books that I don't even want to see the words on paper. So people, get together with everybody and and say, I'm writing nice books. Okay. Whoa, boy, this hour went so fast. Remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, you never know. Maybe 3D. Why? Wouldn't it be nice to see your book done into a 3D movie? You gotta write something really good, and you never know. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, because I love to be saluted, and I love saluting people. Okay, everybody, take a wonderful... Oh, we have to get ready for it. We're having a hurricane. What am I talking? I have to go out and do some shopping. I don't have any food in the house. Zero food. Nothing. I've been so busy all weekend. Okay, I'm running to the store. Everybody, take care. Bye-bye now.